Rolvag's tone was unbearably neutral. The reason I ask, we've found some evidence raising the possibility that your wife went into the water a few hours earlier than you told us. The detective was leaning against the countertop, his hand shoved casually in his pockets. Chaz said, "That's impossible." "I'm sure there's an explanation." "What kind of evidence did you find?" Rolvag winced apologetically. "Afraid I can't discuss it." Locked in his desk at the office was the test confirming that the fingernail tips removed from the marijuana bale belonged to Joey Perone. Chaz said, "This is my wife we're talking about, and you're saying you can't tell me?" He felt his cheeks redden, but that was actually a good thing. He was supposed to look angry. "Did you find her body or not?" "God damn it! I've got a right to know!" Rolvag said, "No, sir, we didn't recover a body. That I can tell you for a fact. Or even a body part." "Then what the hell was it?" Chaz was racking his brain. Joey hadn't been carrying her purse, so it had to be a piece of clothing that had washed ashore somewhere at odds with the computer model of where her body should have floated, factoring in that night's currents and wind. "Is this why you wanted a DNA sample?" Chaz demanded. "It's an active investigation. Certain aspects must remain confidential for the time being," Rolvag said. "I'm sorry, Chaz." It was the first time the detective had used Charles Perrone's nickname, and the sudden informality only heightened Chaz's anxiety. He'd seen enough TV homicide shows to know you were in deep trouble when cops started acting like they were your asshole buddies. "I've lost my wife, and you're playing head games," Chaz said, acting hurt and disappointed. "Just come out and say so if you think I'm lying."
"I think people make mistakes."
"Not this time."
"But you'd been hitting the wine pretty hard that night, is what you told me."
"That's not always good for the memory," Rolvag said. Chaz twisted the cap off another beer and drank slowly, stalling to let his emotions settle. It occurred to him that the detective had unwittingly provided a way out. The Coast Guard had ended its search for Joey, so what was the point in arguing about when she'd gone overboard? If there was anything left of her, which was unlikely after 4 days at sea, it wouldn't really matter how far south she was found. One could always blame a shark or some other deep-water scavenger for carrying her remains out of the search grid. Chaz hung his head.
"I was pretty hammered, that's true. Maybe I did get confused about the time Joey left, or maybe I misread my watch."
For effect, he tapped the crystal of his inexpensive Timex, which he wore only on sampling days in the Everglades. As usual, Rolvag's expression was unreadable.
"Those are two possibilities," the detective said. "Something to think about, anyway. Thanks for the pop."
Chaz laughed.
"The what?"
"The cold drink," Rolvag said. "By the way, somebody's staking out your house. Some big hairy guy in a minivan parked down by the corner. The tag comes back to a rental agency."
"Oh?"
Chaz thinking. "Wait until I tell Red."
"Any ideas?"
Chaz poked his head out the doorway and looked down the street.
"I've got no earthly clue who that man is," he lied. "How do you know that it's me he's watching?"
"Wild guess?" Rolvag smiled. "You've got my card. Call me if you need anything."
"Right," said Chaz, "when goats learn ballet."
He stood at the bay window and watched the prying detective drive away. When the phone began to ring, he almost yanked it out of the living room wall.
"What the hell's happening?" he wondered dismally. "Wasn't I supposed to be home free by now? Off the hook? Cruising?" Instead, that goddamn cop is still snooping around. Some sadistic perv is sneaking into my house and messing with Joey's stuff. And now I've got to deal with some knuckle-dragger of a bodyguard that Red's dredged out of a sinkhole somewhere.
When Chaz answered the phone, the man named Tool was on the other end.
"That guy that just left?"
"What about him?" Chaz said.
"Want me to go after him?"
"And do what?"
Tool grunted.
"I don't know. Bust his spleen?"
Chaz sighed.
He's a cop.
Yeah, so?
Unbelievable, Chaz thought. Leave him be, please.
It's your party, said Tool. Hey, I gotta go take a dump. You gonna be all right?
I think I can manage. Chaz stripped off his clothes and propped himself under a hot shower for 20 minutes. Try as he might, he still couldn't see where he'd made a single mistake in the plan. Not one wrong move. The crime was perfect. It was the rest of the world that was fucking up.
I lied, Joey Perrone said.
This was after a day of doing largely nothing. Swimming, sunning, losing herself in a John D. MacDonald paperback that she'd found in Mick Stranahan's tackle box.
I lied to you, she said again.
Stranahan didn't look up. He was cracking stone crab claws by whomping them with the flat side of a spoon. It was all in the wrist, he'd explained. Fragments of shell were flying around like shrapnel.
Lied about what? He asked.
About not touching anything in the house when I went back inside to take a pee. There was a stash of pictures in the hall closet.
Wedding pictures, that sort of thing?
Wedding, honeymoon, vacations, all shots of Chaz and me, Joey reported, in happier times.
Why were they in a closet?
Because my shitheel husband pulled them off the wall, she said, probably within 5 minutes after he got home from the cruise. I guess he couldn't even stand to look at my face.
Stranahan brushed an orange fleck of crab claw from her cheek.
Tell me what you did.
Joey spun away. Another glass of wine, sir, please.
What did you do with the photos?
Not all of them, just one, she said. All I did was take it out of the frame and slip it under his pillow.
Oh, Christ, Stranahan said.
But first I took cuticle scissors
and cut your face out of the picture.
Joey blinked. How'd you know?
No comment.
Wife or girlfriend?
Spouse number 3, if memory serves, he said.
She sighed. Next time I'll try to be more original. They ate inside, Strom whining for handouts through the screen door. Stranahan was quiet, and Joey began to worry that she'd done something foolhardy, something that might ruin the plan, whatever that was. Firmly, she set down her wine glass. If you want to yell at me for cutting up that picture, go ahead. Just remember, it's my house, too. My stuff that he's throwing away. Stranahan said,
there was no car accident in Tampa involving Chaz and a drunk driver.
How do you know?
Checked with the highway patrol. There wasn't any lawsuit either, he said, according to the court files. And no big settlement, obviously.
Meaning no nest egg, Joey said quietly.
Highly unlikely. You want to hear our plan?
If it'll cheer me up, sure.
We're going to blackmail your husband, Stranahan said.
I see.
Actually, we're only going to make him think he's being blackmailed. Stranahan dipped a jumbo claw into a cup of drawn butter.
Blackmailed by who? Joey asked.
Somebody who knows that Chaz murdered you. Stranahan smiled and took another bite of crab. Somebody will have to invent, of course.
Joey adored the idea, even though she didn't entirely get the point.
Misdirection, he explained. Chaz is probably freaking out that he's being harassed by some mysterious intruder. I'm assuming you don't want him to figure out it's you, at least not yet, correct? She nodded emphatically. No offense, Stranahan said, but these clever little messages you've left for him, the dress in the closet, the lipstick in the drawer, the photograph under the pillow, those are estranged wife-type moves. Too much of that, and he'll put it all together.
Yeah. You're right.
So we need to make him believe it's somebody else who's screwing with his head.
How about somebody who saw him push me off the ship?
Now you're talking.
A secret witness who gets greedy, Joey said eagerly. That would be cool. But who could we make up, Mick?
And how would this imaginary person know how to find Chaz? Wait a minute. How would he get into the house unless he had a key?
Whoa, slow down, Stranahan told her. I've got an idea how to set this up.
I'll bet you do.
Joey Perone felt better than she had in days, and not just because of the wine.
But first it would really help to know why Chaz wanted you dead, said Stranahan.
It would open up some creative opportunities, blackmail-wise.
Joey shrugged helplessly.
That's all I think about, night and day.
Don't worry. We'll figure everything out, he said with a wink. This might actually be fun.
10.
Chaz didn't find the photograph under his pillow until Tuesday night, because he'd spent Monday night at Rika's apartment in self-prescribed sexual therapy. He had blamed Joey's lingering aura for impeding his finale in the bathtub, but leaving the house they shared had failed to solve the problem. Even in Rika's jasmine-scented bedroom, Chaz couldn't shake the image of his dead wife's slinky black dress in the closet, or the wanton memories it conjured. Rika had worked on him as deftly as a sculptress, but the results had been unsatisfactory. For the first time in their relationship, in any relationship, Chaz had heard that most hollow and dreaded of consolations.
Don't worry, baby. It happens to everybody.
In a panic, he dragged Rika to a nearby music store and purchased a replacement copy of George Thorogood's greatest hits, to no avail. Even digitally remastered Bad to the Bone could not rally Chaz's bone to its usual badness. The gloom of failure followed him all the next day, as he drove up and down the levees of the Everglades. It weighed on him still when he returned home, although Rolvag's visit had offered a brief, though grating, diversion. Toppling into bed that night, Chaz was emotionally unprepared for yet another ghoulish shock. He stared at the picture and absently poked a finger in the scissored hole where his wife's pretty face had been. Too vividly he remembered the circumstances of the photograph, which had been taken the previous New Year's Eve at a ski lodge in Steamboat Springs. He and Joey had just emerged from their room after 1 hour and 17 minutes of spectacularly rowdy sex. It was the only time Chaz had ever tired before his wife, and he'd signaled breathless surrender by making a tee with his hands in the manner of a sacked quarterback. He and Joey were still laughing about it later when they'd handed the camera to the bartender. Now, hunched over the photo, Chaz should have been worrying about who had retrieved it from the closet and literally defaced it. He should have been wondering when the act of venomous mischief had occurred, and how the perpetrator had entered the house without breaking a window or prying a door jamb. He should have been summoning the hulking, hairy bodyguard, Red's goon, to find out if any suspicious persons had been lurking in the neighborhood. But instead, Charles Regis Perone found himself thinking of that night only 4 months ago in Colorado, reliving in erotic detail how the woman he fondly once called my monster blonde had turned him inside out. Soon Chaz found himself saluted by a formidable hard-on, which sent him scampering in unwarranted optimism to the bathroom. There he labored doggedly, his face crimson and contorted, until one and then both of his fists cramped. No relief would be forthcoming. Chaz glared down at himself and cursed. My cock was never faithful to Joey while she was alive, he thought. So why all of a sudden now? It was crushing to consider that whatever puny conscience he possessed might manifest itself in such a humiliating way. I didn't want to kill her, he shouted at his chafed and shrinking tormentor. She gave me no choice. Chaz tore the photograph to shreds over the toilet bowl. After checking the doors and windows, he gobbled a half a dozen Maalox chewables and collapsed on the living room sofa. Tomorrow he'd get the locks changed and call the alarm company and move Joey's jewelry to his personal safe deposit box at the bank. Afterward, he would scour the house one more time until nothing remained of his deceased spouse, not one blonde eyelash, to arouse him against his will. Then, on the way back from the county landfill, He'd stop at Walmart and buy himself a gun.
You wouldn't happen to have herbal tea, would you?
The best I can do is coffee, Karl Rolvag said.
Poison, said Rose Jewel with a frown.
No thanks.
She was about 40 years old and fearlessly attractive. The detective office had come to a standstill when she'd walked in. White cotton pullover, tight stonewashed jeans, high heels. Her hair was a wattage of blonde unknown in Minnesota, the land of blondes. Even Rolvag was slightly nervous.
I'm Joey's best friend.
Was Joey's best friend, Rose said. And I just want you to know she would never, ever kill herself, if that's one of your theories.
It's too early for theories, Rolvag said, which wasn't true. He was certain that Charles Perrone had pushed his wife off the Sun Duchess. He was equally sure that proving it would be impossible without a corpse, evidence, or eyewitnesses.
Captain Gallo had thought it interesting that Mrs. Perrone's fingernails were found embedded in a bale of marijuana, but he said it proved only that she'd survived the plunge, not that she had been shoved. Her husband giving the wrong time she'd left the room was suspicious, Gallo agreed, but it wasn't enough on which to file charges. And she didn't get bombed and fall off the ship, either, Rose was saying. I saw that business in the newspaper about her having all that wine. What a bunch of bull. I've never seen Joey drunk, not even close to drunk, not since her DUI.
How was her marriage?
Chaz Perrone was a total slut. He cheated on her all over town.
Did he ever try with you? Rolvag asked, somewhat startled at his own nerve. Perhaps Rose's frankness was contagious.
She smiled and crossed her legs in a way that made the detective feel like a fumbling teenager. If Chaz ever laid a hand on me, she said sweetly, I would have kicked him in the raspberries. But no, I never even met the guy. Rumors of multiple infidelities did not, in Captain Gallo's biased view, automatically make Charles Perrone a murder suspect. In 3 weeks, Rolvag would be heading back to Minnesota, and it was dismaying to know that his final case in Florida would end in failure, a cold-blooded killer escaping justice. The captain had made it plain that he saw the Perrone investigation as a dead end, and that no more time or manpower would be committed. Often Rolvag imagined Mrs. Perrone alone in the ocean, clinging so fiercely to that floating bale that the tips of her nails snapped off one by one. The daydream was more haunting for its detail, since Chaz Perrone had provided a snapshot of his wife to the police and Coast Guard. In the photograph, taken on a beach somewhere, Joey Perrone was dripping wet. The morbid irony had been lost on her husband, but not on the detective, who could now envision Chaz's victim, her blonde hair slicked back, her cheeks sparkling with beads of water, as she must have looked when she burst to the surface after that long, harrowing fall. Except for the smile. Joey Perrone would not have been smiling after her husband threw her overboard. Rolvag said, What do you think happened on that cruise, Miss Jewel?
I know what didn't happen. My friend didn't jump, and she didn't fall.
Rose stood up and slung her handbag over her shoulder. I just wanted somebody to know, that's all. I wanted it written down in a file somewhere.
It will be. I promise.
Rose touched his arm. Please don't give up on this case, she said. For Joey's sake. Rolvag didn't have the heart to tell her that it would take a miracle for him to nail Charles Perrone. On the way home, the detective stopped at the downtown branch of the library to read up on the Everglades. It seemed peculiar that a man so openly averse to nature would study biology and then take a job in a humid, teeming swamp. That Perrone didn't even know which way the Gulf Stream flowed betrayed a certain flimsiness in his academics. His ideals were no less murky and suspect. Rolvag was particularly bothered by Perrone's casual comment about running over snakes with his gas-sucking SUV, and also by the flippant manner with which he dismissed the notion of recycling a pop bottle. Was this a guy who cared about the fate of the planet?
How odd that Chaz Perrone had aimed his career toward the study of organic life when he displayed no concern for any other than his own. However, if a clue lay in the sad and complicated story of the Everglades, Rova couldn't find it. Perrone's connection to such inhospitable wilderness remained a riddle, and time was running short. Driving back to his apartment, Rolvag recalled his own failed marriage and found it impossible to imagine a scenario under which murder would have been an option. In this exercise, the detective felt handicapped by his heritage. Norwegians were natural brooders, not given to the sort of volcanic emotions associated with domestic homicides. But then Rolvag hadn't understood the majority of criminals he had sent off to prison, regardless of their crime. Shooting an ice cream vendor for 34 bucks and change was no more comprehensible to him than launching one's attractive, and by all accounts faithful, spouse over the side of a cruise liner. Why had Perrone done it? Not for money, as there was no insurance payoff, no inheritance, no jackpot whatsoever. And not for love, either. If Chaz had wanted to dump his wife and run off with one of his girlfriends, divorce would have been relatively easy and painless. Florida was a no-fault jurisdiction that dealt perfunctorily with short, childless marriages. Moreover, Mrs. Perrone's substantial personal wealth made her an unlikely candidate for alimony. Gallo's right, Rolvag thought. I've got zilch for a motive. When he arrived home, he saw that a newspaper clipping had been slipped under his door. It was the story of a man in St. Louis who had been strangled and then nearly devoured by an enormous pet python, which he had foolishly neglected to feed for several months. The snake's gruesome repast had been interrupted by a concerned neighbor who scampered for help. Paramedics skilled with the jaws of life arrived and retrieved the victim's grossly elongated body, dispatching the sated reptile in the process. Above the headline, in violet ink, was a familiar spidery scrawl.
This should happen to you.
Rolvag chuckled, thinking, that makes two people who'll be happy to see me go, Chaz Perrone and Nellie Shulman. The detective's own two snakes were coiled together in a large glass tank in the corner of the living room. They were not pure white in the way of some albinos, but rather a creamy hue with exotic tangerine saddle marks. In the urban outdoors, their unnatural brightness could have been a fatal trait, but the pythons were safe in Rolvag's apartment. They displayed no gratitude whatsoever, and seldom moved a muscle except to eat or reposition themselves in a shaft of sunlight. Still, Rolvag enjoyed observing them. That a twerp like Perrone would purposely kill something so primal and perfect angered the detective in a way that surprised him. He shoved a frozen lasagna into the oven and picked through the papers in his briefcase until he found the scrap he was looking for. He dialed the Hertz office in Boca Raton and identified himself to an assistant night manager who was exceptionally cooperative. By the time Rolvag hung up, he had obtained the name of the hirsute thug in the minivan staking out the Perrone residence, and also the name of the company that was paying for the rental. Red's Tomato Exchange. Whatever that was. Joey Perrone shook Stranahan awake.
Mick, I just thought of something.
He sat up on the couch and rubbed his eyes.
Time?
5:45.
This better be good.
He reached for the lamp, but she grabbed his arm. I'm not dressed, she said. Even without lights, the house wasn't that dark. Joey was wearing a white cut-off T-shirt and bikini-style panties, the sight of which mitigated Stranahan's grumpiness.
Tell me what you remembered.
A fight that Chaz and I had about 2 months ago. I was supposed to fly to L.A. for a wedding, but the weather at the airport was horrible, so I turned around and drove home. I won't get on a plane if there's a cloud in the sky. Joey said she'd walked in and found her husband at the dining room table entering numbers on a chart. I was looking over his shoulder, and all I said was, how do you remember them all? Because he wasn't using any notes, just jotting down the figures one after another. So it was like, wow, how can you remember them all?
completely innocent and friendly, and he nearly jumped out of his chair, went absolutely batshit.
That's all you said to him?
It was the craziest thing. He started screaming, stomping around, waving his arms. Told me to quit spying on him and mind my own damn business, Joey said. It was just like the day I asked about the new Hummer, only this time he called me the C-word. That's when I decked him.
Excellent.
A right cross to the chops.
Chaz isn't exactly tough as nails. But you seeing those charts set him off. Do you know what the numbers meant?
He never told me. But part of his job is measuring stuff in the water out there, some type of pollution, Joey said. I'm guessing it had something to do with that.
You really slugged him? Stranahan asked.
Maybe I shouldn't have. Maybe that's what did it, Mick.
Did what? Make him decide to kill you?
Maybe it was too much for his ego.
Stranahan told her not to mistake arrogance for pride. A guy like Chaz can revive his ego with the palm of his hand.
Still, I never saw him freak like that before, Joey said.
It's important. I'm glad you told me.
Hey! Are those genuine Fruit of the Looms?
She reached over and tweaked the waistband. Stranahan slapped a pillow over his lap. Obviously, Mrs. Perrone was overcoming her shyness.
She said, "The sun's almost up. How about a swim?"
Ha ha.
3 laps around the island. Come on, I'm serious.
I thought you were terrified of sharks, he said.
Not if there's 2 of us in the water.
And 1 of us is old and slow, I get the picture.
Oh, don't be such a pussy, Joey said.
Excuse me?
But off she ran, barefoot in her underwear. Stranahan heard the bang of the screen door, followed by a splash. When he reached the dock, there was nothing to do but dive in and try to catch up. Strom watched quizzically, but made no move to join them. Halfway around the island, Joey said, "You're in pretty good shape, for a geezer." Stranahan stopped mid-stroke and treaded water. "What's wrong?" she called out. Ominously, he pointed at the waves beyond her. Joey spotted the 3 gray dorsals cutting the surface and let out a shriek. She kicked backward straight into Mick's arms.
"Don't slug me," he whispered after a few moments. "But those are just dolphins." Slowly, she exhaled, blinking the salt from her eyes.
"So this is how you get your thrills," she said.
"I'm fairly harmless. You can ask around."
The dolphins rolled away, and Stranahan lost sight of them in the sun's glare. Joey kept her arms around his neck, which surprised him.
"That was pretty wild," she conceded. "Better than the Seaquarium. I see them playing out here all the time. You want to keep going?
You mean with the swimming or the groping?"
"I'm not groping," Stranahan said. "I'm trying to keep us afloat.
Your hand is on my ass."
"Technically, that's a thigh, and it's the easiest place to get a grip."
"Oh, nice," she said. "How much do you think I weigh?"
"Not with a gun to my head would I answer that question." He ducked out of her grasp and pushed away.
131 pounds, Joey announced, smoothing the water from her hair. "But I'm tall, almost 5'10".
"You look terrific," he said. "So shut up and let's swim. This was your brilliant idea, remember?"
45 minutes later, they were dry and dressed. He was fixing waffles and she was brewing coffee, and the dog was baying at a boat full of snapper fishermen drifting past the island. Joey said, "Tell me more about the blackmail plan."
"Oh, that reminds me."
He left the kitchen for a minute and returned with the cell phone, which he handed to her.
"Dial your house."
"No way.
You don't have to talk to him. Just dial the number and give me the phone."
"He's got caller ID. He'll see your name," Joey said.
"Then do *67 to block it."
"Mick, what are you going to say to him?"
"Just do it, please."
"Aye, aye, sir."
Stranahan wedged the receiver under one ear as he tended to the waffles. He spoke in a stage voice that caused Joey to stifle a giggle. Is this Charles Perrone? Chaz, we don't know each other yet, but soon you'll be giving me a shockingly large sum of money. No, this isn't the cable company. This is the person who saw you push your lovely wife off the Sun Duchess last Friday night. That's correct. At 11 p.m. sharp, in a drizzling rain, you grabbed her by the ankles and chucked her overboard. Chaz, you still there? Oh, Chaz! Joey applauded after Mick hung up.
That was Charlton Heston you were doing, right? Back in college, we got stoned one night and watched the Ten Commandments and Planet of the Apes back to back.
Stranahan said, I believe I've ruined your husband's morning.
What did he say?
At first, he thought I was trying to sell him digital pay-per-view. Then he accused me of being somebody named Rolvad or Rolvog, playing a sick trick on him. Toward the end, it was more of a gurgle, really, like he'd swallowed some bleach.
What you just did, is that legal? Joey asked.
Possibly not. I'll run it by Father Rourke the next time I go to confession.
You certainly seem to be enjoying yourself.
Chaz deserved a hot little rocket up the ass.
Well, I admire your style.
Now, please tell me again, Stranahan said, why you married a jerk-off like that? Joey's smile evaporated. You'd never understand. It's also none of my business, I admit.
No, I'll tell you why. Because three guys in a row had dumped me for somebody else, okay? Because Chaz sent a single long-stemmed pink rose to my house every day for 2 weeks after our first date. Because he wrote me mushy notes and called me when he promised and took me out for romantic dinners. I was lonely. And obviously he was a pro at that sort of thing, Joey said. And I said yes the second time he asked me to marry him, because, honestly, I didn't want to get dumped again. By the way, this is an unbelievably humiliating subject.
Stranahan said, For God's sake, you're not the first woman to get conned. But then, once you realized it was a mistake, why did I stay married to him?
Mick, it was only 2 years, she said. And not all of it was horrible. Let me try to explain this without sounding like a bubblehead. Chaz was good in bed, and I confess there were times when that canceled out his less admirable qualities.
I understand perfectly, Stranahan said. Hell, that's the story of my life. He stacked three waffles on her plate. Several of my worst marriages were based on dumb lust and not much else. You hungry? Joey nodded.
Me too, Stranahan said. Maple syrup, butter, or both?
The works.
That a girl. They were interrupted by Strom yelping in pain. Stranahan ran outside with Joey close behind. The dog lay at the end of the dock, pawing at an angry knot on his snout. Joey sat down and pulled the whimpering animal onto her lap. In the water, no more than 100 feet away, was the boat with the snapper fishermen. Four of them, chuckling as they pretended to tend their baits. Stranahan spotted an egg-shaped piece of lead on the dock, and slowly he bent to pick it up.
What's that? Joey said. 2-ounce sinker.
Oh, no.
Stranahan called out to the men in the boat. Did you guys throw this at my dog? The fishermen glanced over, murmuring among themselves, until finally the largest one piped up,
Damn thing wouldn't shut up, bro.
Bro? Stranahan thought. So that's what I'm dealing with.
Come over here, he said. We need to talk.
Go fuck yourself,
shouted another of the fishermen, a smaller version of the first.
And your puta girlfriend, too.
Defiantly, he swung back his fishing rod and cast a heavy yellow jig at the dock. It landed short, making a hollow plonk in the water. Stranahan said to Joey, Please take Strom inside the house.
Why? What are you going to do?
Go.
No way am I leaving you alone out here with those morons.
I won't be alone, he said. Stranahan counted three separate breaches of etiquette for which the fishermen deserved rebuke. The first was the casual manner in which they'd violated his privacy by coming so close to the island. The second was their contemptible assault on a rather dull-witted beast that was merely doing its job. The third was the coarse insult directed at Joey Perrone, who had done nothing to provoke it. From the kitchen window, Joey could see the boat motoring toward the dock, all four of the fishermen now standing in anticipation of a fight. Stranahan disappeared briefly inside the shed. He emerged with what he would later identify as a Ruger Mini 14, a semi-automatic rifle of formidable caliber. The intruder's boat was equipped with a 90-horsepower Mercury outboard, into which Stranahan methodically fired three rounds. The men could be seen throwing their arms high in frantic gestures of surrender, and their fearful pleas were audible to Joey even through the closed windows. She couldn't make out Stranahan's precise instructions, but the fishermen dropped to their knees, leaned over the gunwales, and began paddling with their arms. The visual effect was that of an addled centipede in a toilet bowl. Joey tied Strom's leash to a leg of the kitchen table and hurried outside. Stranahan stood with the rifle on one shoulder as he watched the boat laboring crazily toward the mainland.
"So, that's your gun," Joey said.
"Yes, ma'am."
"I'm impressed."
They were, too.
"What you did just now, was it legal?"
Nick Stranahan turned to look at her.
"Please don't ask me that question again."
11. Toole twisted the AC knob to maximum high, and it still felt like 100 damn degrees inside the minivan. American-made, too, which he thought was disgraceful. Florida, of all places, you don't rent out vehicles with cheap-ass air conditioners. Not even 9 in the morning, and already Toole was sweating off the fentanyl patches. To cool down, he removed his boots and overalls, then chugged a liter of Mountain Dew that he'd picked up at the Circle K on Powerline. Fiddling with the radio, he miraculously located a decent country station. Shania Twain was singing about how much fun it was to be a woman, though Toole couldn't see how that could be true. Just about every female he'd ever known, starting with his mother, seemed perpetually pissed off at the human race. Or could be it was just me in particular, Toole thought. At 9:30, the man he was bodyguarding emerged from the house and hurried up the street toward the minivan. Up close he looked shiny and clean-cut. "Awful damn young to be a widower," Toole mused. You couldn't help but wonder what had happened to the guy's old lady. Charles Perrone motioned him to roll down the window.
"Have you seen anybody strange hanging around?"
"Whole goddamn place is strange, you want my opinion," Toole said. "But no, I ain't seen nobody ain't supposed to be here."
"You sure? Because I think they got into my house again."
"Not while I was here, they didn't."
The man looked as if he hadn't slept all night. "Somebody mutilated one of my favorite pictures," he said.
Toole was skeptical. "You want, I'll follow you to work and hang close today. Just in case."
Charles Perrone said he wasn't going to work.
"How come you're not wearing any clothes?" he asked Toole.
"'Cause inside this van it's hotter than an elephant fart." "Hey, Red says you're a doctor."
Charles Perrone seemed pleased.
"That's right."
Toole pivoted his immense mass to display the two remaining patches on his back.
"Can you get me some more of these?" he asked.
The doctor seemed put off by the damp wall of flesh before him.
"Stick on," Toole said. "There's medicine."
"I know, but Duragesic's a brand name. Can you write me a script?"
"No, I'm afraid not," Charles Perrone said.
"It's for super bad pain," Toole explained. "See, there's this bullet slug up the crack of my ass. I'm dead serious."
Charles Perrone blanched and stepped back from the minivan. "Sorry, I don't do prescriptions."
"Now hold on a second. I'm not that kind of doctor."
He spun around and strode back to his house at an accelerated pace. Toole grunted.
That's one lame-ass quack who can't even write scripts.
Two doors down, a middle-aged woman in a yellow linen robe came outside, leading two small animals on leashes. Tool guessed that they were dogs, although they resembled none he'd ever seen. Their roundish, wrinkled faces were flattened, as if they'd run full bore into a cement truck.
The woman herself had a fairly spooky mug, all slick and stretched out like a Halloween mask that was too small for her head.
Tool was treated to a close-up view as she walked the strange pinch-faced dogs down the sidewalk. The woman must not have spotted him inside the minivan, for she nonchalantly allowed her critters to pee all over the right front tire. Tool's instant response was to punch out the passenger window, raining glass upon the woman's sandaled feet. She bleated in fear as he stuck his head out the window and instructed her in the crudest terms to clean up the damn mess.
What?
She yanked the dogs away from the van and gathered them into her arms.
Just who do you think you are, mister?
I'm the some bitch gonna butt-fuck those puppies. You don't clean the piss off my tar.
He cracked the door enough for the woman to see all she needed. In a heartbeat, she was on her knees, furiously dabbing at the wet tire with a wad of pink tissue while her pets whined and scrapped nearby. When she was finished, Tool said,
I didn't hear no apology.
The woman made a spiteful sound and her cheeks turned red, yet her expression never changed. The skin from her forehead to her chin was so tight and glossy that Tool wondered if she might split open like a bad mango.
Beat it,
he said. And she did, sandals slapping in retreat. The accordion-faced dogs could barely keep up. Minutes later, the doctor reappeared.
What did you do to Mrs. Raguso?
He demanded.
She let her damn mutts take a leak on my tar,
Tool protested.
I thought this was supposed to be a class neighborhood, what they call upscale. Hell, I live in a trailer, and I wouldn't let my dogs pee on someone else's personal vehicle.
Charles Perrone said, You'd better get out of here. Carmen Raguso is probably calling the police right this minute.
What for? She's the one started it.
You flashed her. I was watching from the living room. Charles Perrone had got himself quite worked up. I don't want to deal with any more cops, you understand? Now hurry up before she gets your license tag.
Well, who's going to watch your house?
Just keep driving, Charles Perrone said, until you hear from Mr. Hammernut. He'll tell you what to do next.
Shit, said Tool, and started backing down the street.
At the corner, he wheeled the minivan around, then shot forward at high speed toward the exit of West Boca Dunes, Phase 2. More than an hour passed before the cell phone rang. But by then, Tool had scored two more fatality markers from the grass median of the Sawgrass Expressway. The flowers had rotted down to the ribbons, yet the crosses themselves were in mint condition. Consequently, Tool's outlook was much improved by the time Red Hammernut called.
On this bodyguard thing, Red said, the trick is you gotta blend in.
I've never been too good at that.
Okay, let me work up another plan.
Meantime, can I swap out the minivan? Tool asked.
By all means.
Get me something with a decent AC.
You bet.
By the way, your boy ain't much of a doctor.
Red Hammernut chuckled.
Don't you dare tell a soul.
Mick Stranahan and Joey Perrone were surprised to see Chaz's yellow Humvee when they came around the corner at 10:30. Guess who's taking a sick day, Joey said. Stranahan positioned the Suburban in the driveway of the fugitive telemarketers, same as the last time. Moments later, a panel truck turned onto the street and drove past the Perrone house, then braked, reversed, and pulled in beside the Hummer. Painted in red lettering on the sides of the truck, Sunshine Locksmith.
Damn, Stranahan said. He's changing the locks.
So what?
So the spare key in the bird feeder won't fit.
Joey raised an eyebrow. Wait and see. Soon another truck appeared, It was a small white pickup with magnetic signs on the doors. Gold Coast Security Systems.
Now what? Stranahan grumbled.
He's reconnecting the alarm.
Terrific.
Would you please stop worrying, Joey said.
Just so you know, I'm not keen on B&Es.
Translation?
Break-ins. They're messy, Stranahan said, and very hard to explain if the cops show up.
Are your window screens wired?
No, but there are motion detectors in the hallway and bedrooms. I suppose Chaz could put in more, depending on how spooked he is.
I would say plenty spooked, said Stranahan, based on what we're seeing.
It was your phone call, Mick, the Moses impersonation.
Let's not forget the snapshot under his pillow.
Oh, yeah. Joey would have given anything to see her husband's face when he found it. By noon, the locksmith and the alarm technician were gone, but Charles Perrone hadn't come out of the house. Joey was restless, ready to roll. She had tucked her hair under a Marlins cap and costumed herself in long pants and a loose-fitting work shirt. Instead of a Bible, her prop this time was a toolbox. Someone watching her come down the sidewalk might have mistaken her for a man because of her height and long athletic stride.
What if he's really sick in bed? She said.
Stranahan was scanning the place with the binoculars.
Give him one more hour.
A blue car turned the corner and approached the Perrone residence. It was the Ford Compact belonging to the woman with the Kelly Green pubic hair. Joey groaned.
You've got to be kidding.
Take it easy now.
What? He can't even make it past lunch without getting his rocks hauled?
Stranahan said, looks like she's not going in.
Two short honks came from the Ford, then the front door of the house opened. Out came Charles Perrone, carrying a brown paper bag. See that golf shirt he's wearing? I gave him that for his birthday, Joey said. New set of irons, too.
Chaz got in on the passenger side, and the blue car pulled away.
Joey noted that the woman was wearing large Jackie Onassis-style sunglasses, probably so she won't be recognized from her porno flicks.
Stranahan advised Joey to stay focused on her no-good husband.
What do you want to do?
I want to go back in the house. My house.
But how?
Wait here, she said, until you see the sprinklers come on.
Stranahan touched her wrist. The second the alarm goes off, I'm rolling. Be sure to come out the front door, not the back, then walk very calmly to the street.
Mick, don't you dare leave me stranded here. That would really suck.
Come to think of it, I still owe you one.
Not the stolen boat thing again.
Joey sighed as she hopped out of the Suburban.
How many times did I say I was sorry? Like a dozen?
Stranahan had been underestimating women for about 40 years, so he was not flabbergasted to see the lawn sprinklers bloom at the former residence of Joey Perrone. He would have congratulated her merely for getting past the new locks. That she'd also thwarted the security alarm was truly impressive. When she met him at the door, he asked, "Were you a burglar in a previous life?"
"No, a wife," Joey said.
Chaz hid the new key in the same bird feeder just like I knew he would.
Because,
see, it was his idea the first time. He was so proud of himself, thought he was so darn clever, and since I'm the only other person who knew about the hiding place,
and he thinks you're dead,
exactly. Why not hide it there again, she said. He probably figures that whoever snuck into the house scored the old key from our cleaning service, or maybe the guy who does the aquarium.
Okay, but how'd you disarm the alarm?
Now, Mick, put on your thinking cap.
He grinned. Don't tell me Chaz used the same keypad code as before.
Yep, Joey said. 2-21-72.
Sounds like a birthday.
Bingo! I knew he'd be too lazy to make up a new sequence.
Still, that's quite a gamble you took, Stranahan said.
Not really. Not knowing him the way I do.
They sat in the dining room, Chaz's mud-smeared backpack on the table.
Joey said she'd once bought him a nice leather briefcase, but he had told her it was impractical for working in a swamp. Stranahan unfastened the backpack's many buckles and zippers and emptied the contents pocket by pocket. A sheath of loose papers and charts, a handful of mechanical pencils, 2 aerosol cans of insect spray, a snake bite kit, tape and gauze, a pair of heavy cotton socks, canvas gloves, rubberized gloves, chlorine tablets, a tube of antibiotic ointment, a rolled-up Danish skin magazine, a bag of stale chocolate donuts, a pound of trail mix, and a plastic bottle of Maalox tablets. "Your husband has a nervous tummy. That could be helpful," Stranahan said. Joey leafed through the papers. "This is the same kind of stuff he was working on the day he got so mad at me."
"You were right. They're charts for water samples."
Stranahan removed a blank form, folded it up, and slipped it into the pocket of his Florida Power and Light shirt. "That's all we're taking?" she asked.
"For now, yes."
He carefully replaced each of the other items in the backpack. "That was a nice little bonus. Now, where does Squire Perrone hide his checkbook?" "Be right back." Joey disappeared down the hallway and returned carrying at arm's length a crusty, soiled sneaker. "Never been washed," she reported distastefully. A clever idea, Stranahan had to admit. Even the most desperate of thieves avoid rancid footwear. Joey turned the shoe upside down and the checkbook dropped out. Flipping through the register, Stranahan found no unusual transactions. The only deposits were Chaz Perrone's bi-monthly paychecks from the state of Florida.
"When did you say he bought the Hummer?" Stranahan asked Joey.
"Middle of January."
"There's nothing here, not even a down payment."
"Maybe he's got another account I don't know about," she said.
"Or maybe he didn't pay for the Hummer himself," Stranahan thought.
"What about Chaz's so-called nest egg?" he asked. Joey shook her head weakly. "Stocks and bonds?"
"Then he should get brokerage statements in the mail."
Joey admitted that she'd never seen any. Stranahan stood up and said it was time to go before Chaz returned with his lady friend. "Wait. Let's leave him another present." Joey was eyeing one of her husband's umbrellas, which was leaning in a corner.
"Absolutely not," Stranahan said.
"Mick, come on. He's already a nervous wreck, I assure you." Joey feigned a pout as she followed him to the door. "At least can I leave the sprinklers running?"
"Is the timer box outside?"
She nodded. "On the wall outside the utility room. He'll have no reason to think that we actually got into the house."
"And sure, what the hell," Stranahan said. "If it makes you feel better."
"It'll do for now," said Joey, and reset the alarm. Rika remarked that Chaz looked dreadful.
"I didn't sleep much," he mumbled.
"That's because I wasn't there to tire you out. Some crank called first thing this morning." "A breather?" Rika asked. "I get those all the time."
"No, just a crank." Thinking about the mystery phone call, Chaz felt his palms go damp.
Rika asked if he had given any more thought to holding a memorial service for Joey.
"What is it with you?" he said irritably. "I already told you I hate funerals. Light a goddamn candle if it makes you feel better."
Rika said, "Doesn't have to be a major production. Rent a chapel, get the priest to say a few words. Maybe some of Joey's friends would like to share their feelings too."
Chaz stared out the window.
"It's important, baby," she said, "for closure."
He exhaled scornfully, blowing invisible smoke rings.
"One chapter of your life has ended," Rika went on, "and another is just beginning."
Jesus, Chaz thought. She's about as subtle as a double hernia.
"Besides, it'll look bad if you don't do something in Joey's memory. It'll look like you don't even care that she's dead."
Rika had a point. Eventually he might have to stage a service for the sake of appearances. He was surprised that Detective Rolvag hadn't called him on that, too.
"The crooked, blackmailing son of a bitch.
It had to be him, the voice on the phone.
Chaz, are you listening to me?
Rika said.
Do I have a choice?
She made a sad-sounding noise.
Baby, I'm just trying to be here for you.
Right, thought Chaz. Here, there, and everywhere. He said, maybe I'll arrange a memorial for later, in a couple weeks, thinking, after all, this heavy-duty shit is behind me. Rika remained in the car while he went inside the bank. Later, at lunch, he got around to asking what was in the paper bag. It was jewelry, Chaz said. I was putting it in a safe box.
Your wife's jewelry?
No, Liz Taylor's. She asked me to hold it for her.
Don't have to get snotty, Rika said.
Chaz mustered an apology.
I've got a jillion things on my mind. You want to stop over my place for a fashion show? I just got a new box of thongs from Rio.
Not today, sweetie. I've got to haul a major load of trash out to the county landfill. Rika froze, a forkful of linguine halfway to her mouth.
Let me get this straight. You'd rather go to a garbage dump than get laid?
Chaz said,
come on, it's not that simple.
At least he hoped it wasn't. 12. On the drive back to Miami, Joey started thinking about the last time she and her husband had had sex, in their cabin aboard the Sun Duchess, less than 5 hours before he tossed her overboard. She couldn't recall that Chaz had behaved any differently in bed. His performance had been typically voracious and unflagging. It infuriated her to think that he could have enjoyed himself with such abandon, knowing that before midnight he would murder his partner in pleasure. I need you to explain something about men, she said to Mick Stranahan, because I truly don't understand.
Fire away.
Chaz and I did it on the ship while we were getting ready for dinner. This is the night he tried to murder me.
As if everything was hunky-dory.
Exactly, Joey said. How could he even get it up?
I believe it's called compartmentalizing.
And you've done this yourself?
On rare occasions, Stranahan said.
Examples, please.
He answered hesitantly. Well, there was this one time I made love to a woman 45 minutes before I moved out.
And you knew you were leaving?
Yep. I'd already rented my own place.
And she had no clue? None whatsoever?
Evidently not, Stranahan said, judging by her reaction. Joey was watching him closely.
Well, don't stop now. Going to bed. Was that your idea or hers?
They say it relieves stress, and God knows I was stressed.
Oh, please, she said. You just wanted one last taste.
I suppose that's possible.
Men are such slugs.
Stranahan kept his eyes on the traffic. For what it's worth, I would never toss a woman off a ship after having wild sex with her, or even tame sex.
Spoken like a true gentleman. And may I submit that your husband, don't call him that anymore, please?
All right, Stranahan said. May I submit that Chaz is light years beneath common male slugdom. He is one cold-hearted prick, and let's not forget it.
Wearily, Joey slid down in the seat. What's it called when you start hating yourself?
A waste of energy.
No. Self-loathing, I think. All these questions keep banging around my head. What the hell were you thinking, Joey? Why didn't you see through this guy? How come you put up with all his whoring around? Mick, we're talking about a serious deficiency of self-esteem here.
She felt a hand lightly brush one of her cheeks. He was checking for tears.
Don't worry, she said. I'm so over that.
Figure we got almost one healthy ego between us. That ought to be enough.
Why are you helping me? Joey heard herself ask.
Because I miss chasing after guys like Chaz.
It was the best part of my job, sending shitheads up the river. You're not just trying to get in my pants? Stranahan drummed his fingers on the steering wheel. You know, I'd be just fine if you didn't keep bringing up the subject. God, I'm starved. Let's grab something to eat. We'll be home in an hour, he said. Joey didn't argue. She knew how much Mick hated the city. Sometimes I think about killing Chaz. Seriously, she admitted. Last night I dreamed I beat him to death with one of his umbrellas. Is that crazy? Stranahan said she'd be crazy not to feel angry. But this is a much smarter way of dealing with it. With any luck, neither of us will end up in prison or the nut house. Did we really accomplish anything today? I mean, besides watering the lawn? Definitely. Stranahan patted his breast pocket. The chart I took from Chaz's backpack is used for recording phosphorus levels at water sampling stations. Those were probably the numbers he was writing down the day he wigged out on you. Phosphorus? Is that the same as phosphate? Joey asked. Like in fertilizer? Yes, indeed. Not good for the Everglades. Not according to what I've read, no, Stranahan said. Joey was struggling to make it all fit. Okay, say Chaz was slacking at work. Instead of schlepping out to the boonies, he sneaks off to play golf. Later, he cooks up a bogus water chart to fool his boss. Sounds like our boy. Then I come home unexpectedly, ask one innocent question, Joey said, and he's so paranoid that he thinks I've figured out the whole scam, caught him red-handed. And then he loses it. Yeah, but hold on. Do you really believe he tried to kill me over that? Over fertilizer? I'm not saying this is the whole answer. It's just a piece of the puzzle, Stranahan said. Joey was skeptical. It seemed entirely possible that Chaz's tantrum 2 months ago had nothing to do with what had happened last week on the cruise ship. Even if he'd been fudging some scientific data, the guy wasn't exactly trading in atomic secrets. She said, "Before this is over, I want a one-on-one with him. Can you make that happen?" "Joey, it all depends." When they got to Dinner Key, Stranahan parked the Suburban next to the old Cordoba under the ficus tree. A chilly rain started falling as they reached the skiff, and they shared a poncho on the choppy ride out to the island. Carl Rolvag drove north on U.S. 27, the glistening sedge of the Everglades giving way to cane fields as far as he could see. At Lake Okeechobee, the detective headed west on State Road 80, toward the town of La Belle. He was taking his time, enjoying the wide-open drive. The flat farmlands checkered in shades of green reminded him of western Minnesota in the summer. The address of Red's Tomato Exchange turned out to be the same as that of Hammernut Farms. Rolvag followed a straight gravel road for a half a mile until it dead-ended at a modern brick complex that belonged in a suburban office park. The receptionist peered at Rolvag's badge, made a quiet call, and then offered him coffee, soda, or lemonade. A woman identifying herself as Mr. Hammernut's executive assistant appeared and led the detective to a conference room overlooking a stagnant, though perfectly circular, pond. On the paneled walls of the room were framed photographs of governors, congressmen, Norman Schwarzkopf, Nancy Reagan, Bill Clinton, the three Bushes, and even Jesse Helms, each posing with a shorter, reddish-haired man whom Rolvag assumed to be Samuel Johnson Hammernut. Undoubtedly, the pictures were displayed to remind Hammernut's guests that they were dealing with a heavy hitter. From his own hasty internet research, Rolvag had learned that Hammernut's enterprises extended well beyond Florida. Soybeans in Arkansas, peanuts in Georgia, cotton in South Carolina. Plainly, he made important friends wherever he chose to do business. He'd also gotten into occasional trouble for brutal labor practices and a casual disregard for pollution laws. That he had skated away with only comical fines was hardly surprising to Rolvag, considering Hammernut's deep-pocket connections with both political parties.
"Call me Red,"
he said, after a sniffling and somewhat unimposing entrance.
Damn allergies get me every spring. What can I do you for?
The detective told Hammernut about the unusual man in the minivan at West Boca Dunes Phase 2. The license tag came back to a Hertz agency. They said the rental was billed to a corporate credit card, Red's Tomato Exchange. Hammernut nodded.
I own that company, yes sir, and half a dozen others.
You know a person named Earl Edward O'Toole?
Not off the top of my head. Did he say he worked for me?
I didn't speak with him personally, but I got a good look. He's a very distinctive individual, Rolvag said.
How so?
Size-wise.
We hire lots of large fellas out here. Let me ask Lisbeth.
Hammernut leaned across the table and poked a button on the speakerphone.
Lisbeth, we got anybody on the payroll name of Earl Edward?
He turned back to Rolvag.
What was it again?
O'Toole. That's what was on the car rental contract.
O'Toole,
Hammernut repeated for Lisbeth, who said she would check. Less than a minute later, the phone buzzed. This time, Hammernut turned off the speaker and snatched up the receiver.
Okay, yeah, I think I remember him. Thank you, darling.
The detective opened his notebook and waited. Hammernut hung up and said,
That big old boy used to be a crew boss round here, but not for some time. I don't know how he come to get hold of that credit card, but I aim to find out.
Do you know where he works now?
Nope. Lisbeth said he left on account of medical problems, Hammernut said. It's hard running a crew. Maybe he just got broke down and wore out.
Rolvag went through the motions of scribbling in his notebook. Can you think of any reason Mr. O'Toole was hanging around that particular neighborhood in Boca? He didn't hurt anybody, but still it's a matter of concern for some of the residents. You can understand.
Oh, hell yes, Red Hammernut said. If he's the same old boy I'm thinking of, he could scare hot piss out of an igloo.
Rolvag managed to chuckle. Mind if I take a look at his personnel file?
What file? Ha!
Hammernut roared.
We got, like, index cards. Half these fellas were lucky they copped to their real names. That's a problem with your itinerant labor.
The detective nodded commiseratively. You'd tell me, I'm sure, if your record showed that Mr. O'Toole had a history of violence or mental instability. Hammernut sneezed and groped in his pockets for a handkerchief.
Psychos ain't much use on a farm operation like mine. Somebody turns out to be a goony bird, he don't last long.
But you get all kinds, I bet, Rolvag said.
You say this boy hasn't hurt nobody.